My Pilgrimage to Hell. The Descent. There was no judgment, merely the definitive moment. With a sensation, like the sudden flash of a whip, the veil separating life from death was ripped away, and my consciousness was pulled violently into the realm beyond life. Translucent bindings, like strings of light, first lassoed my legs, then seized my whole being, and I was slammed forward. I felt myself hurled down and down. There was no me, just a center of consciousness descending farther and farther, falling into untold depths. I was dead. I had no eyes to see. I had no ears to hear. No nose to smell. No tongue to taste. No skin to feel. No voice to speak. All I had was a memory of those senses and those sense perceptions. Yet, though I had no eyes, a world appeared before me. My consciousness expanded from the tiny strings of light and into a complete cosmos made of sulfurous gases. Here was an alternative world, thoroughly different from the earthly world I had left behind. My senses were overwhelmed by the unbearable odor of burning flesh and extremes of heat and cold beyond imagination. Amid these intense sensations, a second display arose in shimmering waves of agonizing pain. The images of contorted faces, writhing bodies, and ghastly body parts, festering entrails, disembodied thumbs and noses, tormented animals of every kind, some of them ripped into pieces, and even ants and other insects whose extreme suffering was palpable to me. All of them, all of it, was a mass of unspeakable pain. With the constant mirage-like wavering of images, I could not discern anything as either real or unreal. Space had no ordinary dimensionality, no up or down, no right or left. Only the habit of direction was there to produce the continuous sense of falling, but without any place to fall. From within the chaotic shimmering emerged a being of sublime light. Was it male or female? I could not say. A wordless message was somehow conveyed to me. This is the domain of hell. You have been brought here as a guest to witness and understand the suffering of beings of all kinds, particularly the suffering of human beings. This sublime being, whom I came to think of as the Buddha of hell, appeared as a luminous presence within the heavy atmosphere and constant shifting of the hell environment. The luminosity had a calming effect upon me, so I was able to resist succumbing to a monumental panic attack. The presence of the Buddha of hell was imbued with kindness. As this benevolent light being drew me close, I felt great relief that such an unimaginably horrifying experience was happening only in order to show me the true nature of hell. The reassurance took the form of a beacon that brought some clarity to the chimerical nature of the experience. From now on, my perception came only through the subtle wisdom eyes of this awakened being of light, the Buddha of hell, whose presence remained with me, not speaking, but giving me inwardly the understandings I needed to know to make sense of what I beheld. With the appearance of this magnificent presence, my journey through the various levels of hell commenced. Borderland. It is difficult to explain. I call them levels. How else could I say it? I use the word levels for different phenomena happening within the realm at the same time. But all of hell existed simultaneously in the same space, non-space. To speak about it as if there were different levels existing separately from other levels is not accurate. Yet there is no adequate way to convey what I was shown. The circles of hell, as they manifested to me, didn't exist as a hierarchy. That is, there wasn't one circle that went down or up to another circle, which in turn went down or up to another circle, and so on. All the circles of hell existed as if in the same realm, on the same level, each superimposed on the other. Only in the ordinary sense of space can one speak accurately of separate hells or separate circles. But I must do so if I am to speak of them at all. The entry point for the tour of hell was at what seemed to be the center of the hell realm, at a place where the series of hells intersected, not only hot hells, but cold ones as well. It was like a borderland between them. The borderland felt familiar, like our own planet. Nonetheless, the experience there was nothing like ordinary earthly existence. In these borderlands, the qualities of the hot and cold hells interpenetrated each other, like coexisting parallel dimensions. With a great sucking noise, my consciousness was pulled through a central channel, and the extremely vast hellscape appeared before me. The ground was crystalline ice, from which blue-hot flames emerged at the outer edges. All was hot. All was frozen. Everything was ignited with hellfire. Underneath the frozen, icy expanse were innumerable forms of hell beings, mummified into the ice, but at the same time, ablaze. This hell universe was both terrifying and reassuring. It came to me later that this initial experience was in fact quite auspicious, in that I had fallen into the palm of the Buddha of Hell. Through simultaneously feeling the textures of fire and water that he displayed to me, there arose an experience of non-duality, which brings freedom from the addiction to dualities of all kinds: self and other, form and emptiness, samsara and nirvana. Knowing this was the saving grace that allowed me to traverse hell under the Buddha of Hell's guidance, and was simultaneously the catalyst that could liberate any being that found itself in this forsaken realm. Entrance into the hot hells occurred not by any normal means of transportation, such as walking or being driven or sailing. It was simply a shift, a choice of mind. Once we arrived at the borderline where the hells all intersected, such a shift occurred, and the Buddha of Hell introduced me to the phenomena and the beings of the hot hells. In the course of the journey, the Buddha of Hell manifested in many ways, as space and luminosity within the claustrophobic environment, and as warmth within the completely frozen wastelands. I gradually became accustomed to the fact that I was in hell, and so my faculties of consciousness were refreshed to the touch of the Buddha's hand. My vision of him changed. He had first appeared as pure light, neither male nor female. Subsequently, the perception clarified to a body of light with a halo, and then to a gray, masculine body surrounded by flames. I was now also able to experience the constant impending doom that each hell being feels, and I eventually began to have a sense of non-sentimental compassion for these beings rather than disdain or repulsion. The landscape of hell is a vast expanse with countless inhabitants, veritable oceans of suffering beings. The suffering of each and every one of these beings are due to their own mental conceptions. In fact, their suffering in hell is an unbroken continuation of their own states of mind during life, which persisted even after the death of the physical body. Beings enter hell as a result of the sum total of their own life at the time of death. Whatever they brought to their lifetime, including all actions, thoughts, belief systems, desires, and habits of clarity or obscuration, all continues beyond the passing of the physical body. After the demise of the body, even though the being is deceased, a consciousness persists and can still suffer, if that has been its primary habit pattern. It creates a hell body for itself out of its habitual mental conceptions. Nose, arms, legs, all are pieced together. However, in this hellish world, there is no guarantee that the body will end up in the right configuration. Despite being already dead, these beings can be released from their hell bodies at some point to be reborn into another realm. It is for this reason that the Buddha of hell is present among them. His consciousness is not subject to any of the conditionality of hell, but remains there purely out of compassion to help beings to eventually find a way out of their seeming eternity of misery. Upon arrival at the hot hells, I felt I had entered a fiery furnace of unbelievable proportions. An ordinary body could not exist in the furnace of hell because it is so intensely seething with unbearable heat. Flames are everywhere. Flames of red and flames of blue and flames of yellow, all so exceedingly searing and scorching. But hot is more like a metaphor for what the experience of heat is actually like in hell. It is a metaphor, but at the same time, a physical reality. Bodies in hell are also a metaphor, but at the same time, they are physical phenomena. The skin burns, but is not burned away. It remains to be burned again and again. The pain of burning is constant. It continues for centuries upon centuries, yet one never gets used to it. The burning pain comes from below, from the sides, and from above in this horizonless realm. Infinite numbers of beings are everywhere, burning amid the wall-to-wall flames. Some are melting, but they never melt away or burn up. They continuously melt and burn, melt and burn. It would soon become clear that an inescapable characteristic of hell is the sheer redundancy of self-created sufferings, which pound consciousness in seemingly perpetual cycles. Not only is there burning, but there is a tremendous pressing that causes all the denizens of the hot hells to have the worst possible claustrophobia. Relief can never come, because there is no escaping into unconsciousness. Everyone is dead here, so how can anyone pass out? The horrors of hell just continue over and over without ceasing. Although countless hell beings are pressing against one another, each of these beings feels that it is totally separated from all other beings. Yet all the other countless hell bodies are pressing against its own hell body and burning along with it. Rage is pervasive. Everybody is enraged with everybody else because each one feels that their suffering is someone else's fault. The entire hell realm is sizzling with anger and crackling with hatred. There is no sense of unity in the spirit of, we are all in this together. No, all the denizens are thoroughly infuriated by everybody and everything else. All are in a constant state of irritation, claustrophobia, and pressure. In a crazy-making feedback loop, the anger from these feelings flames out in the form of even more heat, which rebounds and reduces the amount of space even further, exacerbating the sense of suffocation. The mutual irritation of beings causes the space around them to become relentlessly compressed. The ever-decreasing space is what makes the sense of time stretch into endless aeons. What a paradox. They are all packed together, yet they are all separated. Bizarrely, hell is like one huge being composed of all the denizens of hell. Because they are trapped in the perspective of individual pain and individual suffering, there is no way for the hell beings to see that each hell being is made up of the pain and anger and karmic results of a lifetime. So even though the body of hell is crammed with innumerable beings, each individual feels totally separated from every other individual, even while it is part of this entire horrific being that is the body of hell. Claustrophobia of the Hot Hells. With the inner feeling that the Buddha of hell was leading me by the hand, I made my way through the vast flaming chasm of torturous heat. The landscape was actually composed of burning bodies. Many small and large bodies resembling bubbling hot lava were embedded into the fire mountains. Like the fire mountains, the fire buildings in the fire cities were totally made from fiery substance. But despite all this, the hot hell denizens still held on to the concept that their bodies were made of flesh, bone, and blood. Thus, they experienced that their flesh burned, their bones melted, and their blood curdled and turned into steam. The sensations were excruciating, excruciatingly freaky. But there was no relief, no passing out, no death, just baking, frying, boiling. Screams were heard everywhere. Cries and gasps filled the whole of the hell space. Those in the fields of hell were crushed by flaming boulders and molten rocks that fell on them. There was so much running, but where could anyone run when everything was aflame? The habit bodies of the hot hell beings merged with the lava to become monuments of zombie stone. From all directions, the heat exerted more and more pressure upon the denizens. The most extreme paranoia was combined with the most extreme claustrophobia. Everyone wanted nothing but for all of this to be over. But there was nothing to be over because in hell, everything lasts close to forever. Not quite forever, but very, very close to forever. The phenomena of the hot hells can be very simply described. Everything is unbearably hot. There are levels ranging from unbearably hot to unbearably hotter. It is all unbearable. The turbulence caused by forceful winds like solar flares was inescapable. There is no let-up of any kind. There is no equivalent of water, no equivalent of a cool breeze, not to mention any equivalent of air conditioning, nor anything that could give comfort or relief to those stuck in the hot hells. The degree of heat, claustrophobia, and crowding, the utter distress and despair is monumental. The hot hells are impossibly jammed beyond capacity with human beings, animals, ghosts, beings of all kinds, all stuck in their habit bodies, all suffering, and at the same time angry that they are suffering. An environment of constant panic is stirred by the flames and surges of ever stronger heat. The more the anger at being stuck increases, the hotter hell becomes. At first, I was overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of hell denizens. Then gradually, it became possible to distinguish individual beings, one by one. I saw that although each being viewed itself as separate and alone, all were actually a part of one larger being. That huge being might have been, in turn, a part of another galaxy of beings. The Tunnel of Suicides, Omar. At the fringe of the Hell Realms, there suddenly appeared a chasm of fire, with a gaping entrance. It was like a reverse oven, drawing in flames from outside itself, instead of creating flames by burning within. Flames were being sucked into the Tunnel of Suicides. It was the entry point for those who take their own lives in the belief that they can obliterate their suffering and become one with nothingness. An infinite number of people have killed themselves out of despair, depression, shame, derangement, the pain of illness, or stupidity. Somehow, the mind and body went completely out of sync, so that the instinct to survive was overpowered by the mind's haze of delusion about the nature of life and death. This led to an extreme game of chicken played against oneself. Should I continue to suffer, or should I kill myself? Staying alive will mean nothing but more depression, more pain, more shame. If I kill myself, there will be no me left to feel pain, and other people will no longer exist for me, neither those who despise me nor those who mourn me. These thoughts are like demons that taunt the person and convince them that committing suicide is a sensible thing to do and the solution to all problems. Their reasoning faculty has deteriorated to the point where they are convinced that all phenomena, good and bad, will be snuffed out as soon as they take their last breath. Surprise! Succumbing to the compulsion to suicide has led them directly to the chasm and tunnel of the hot hells. Not that every suicide is a wretch who will directly enter the tunnel. A small minority of suicides consciously sacrifice their own lives to benefit others, like the combatant who willingly dies so that fellow soldiers or innocent civilians may live. And then there are those who euthanize themselves to impart some modicum of dignity to their exit from life due to a terminal illness, and to spare loved ones from the pain of witnessing their deterioration. These types of suicide usually understand that life and death are part of the same continuum, that each death implies a new life, and that each new life implies a death. They are not caught up in wishful thinking, but understand the gravity of their decision. For the desperate or confused suicides, the act is followed at first by a kind of voidness, an absence of any sensation. They lie unconscious in the jaws of death, tranquilized by their decision. Then there is a rude awakening as the jaws of death begin to crunch down and chew them. All of the emotions they had as they departed life become super intense because there is no longer a gross physical body to act as a buffer to dull or contain them. The negative feelings and dark thoughts run riot. The mind has become a greater problem than the person could ever have imagined. Death salivates and chomps upon these thoughts and emotions, and the throat of death is the fiery chasm that sucks these beings into the ghastly tunnel of lost souls. For aeons, each of these frantic beings is trapped in a chaotic environment of hell flames of despair that manifest in reddish orange and blue hues, amid wild eruptions of panic, incredulity, and unending grief, their own and others. In the distant echo, the sounds of explosion and cries of anguish, and then more explosions and sobbing. Within the tunnel of suicides, there is not a single shred of hope for escape, nor even for resting, not even for a second. The wishful fantasy that all the pain would end upon death has now become the freakish reality that there is no end of any kind. We next came upon an adjacent region that was crowded with recent arrivals. There were men and women who expected that they were about to enter a heavenly paradise, a blissful land of flowing rivers, blooming gardens, and luxurious mansions, where everlasting youth, beauty, and sensual pleasures awaited them, the true believers. They were so wrong. In their hateful and reasonless zeal, they held tight to the conviction that by violently destroying those deemed infidels who held views different from their own, they would be extravagantly rewarded by the supreme deity they worshipped. In life, they had either volunteered or been forced to carry bombs into public places, to terrorize these perceived enemies by maiming and killing huge crowds of people, sacrificing their own lives in the process. These brutal acts of mass murder were their tickets to paradise. The men were certain that beautiful, pure maidens would be their companions in an eternal, heavenly life. The women bombers, too, had been promised eternal happiness, as well as revenge against all who had wronged them. The bombers had walked or driven amid hapless crowds of innocent children, women, and men. The bombers' waists were wrapped with explosive combined with steel nails and other sharp objects. The sweat from their agitated bodies produced a putrid odor like sulfurous excrement. In their delusionary fervor, they imagined that their actions were heroic, that giving up their lives in the act of destroying others, by blasting living bodies to pieces or piercing them with sharp objects, was the height of noble martyrdom. The minds that embraced these delusions were as putrid as their sweat. Here, in their special corner of hell, everything was saturated with the stench of their worldly perspiration as they eagerly awaited the entry into paradise. But no maidens came to serve them, no god to greet them. There was no joy in having destroyed their enemies. This was hell, after all. But because they still clutched tight to the perverse expectation that they were to be rewarded for their acts, their minds projected a perpetual recurrence of their deranged crimes. As they milled around among one another, they hallucinated the existence of those whom they had murdered, so that they could murder them again. Caught as they were in hell, they only experienced the recurring pain and anguish of being blown apart, constantly becoming their own enemies, who were also blown up maimed, and killed by themselves. Here, in suicide bomber hell, there was no death to end the cycle of violence. Each time they were dismembered, the molecules of their body parts reformed into new enemies, into new versions of themselves, to experience again and again the sudden bomb blasts and the burning of their lungs, heart, and brain. Not realizing that the people they were murdering were in fact themselves, they kept exploding. Each time, a horrific surprise awaited them. Each time, they forgot what they had learned a few seconds before. Each time, their habit of destruction was refueled. This part of hell was extremely dark. For these suicide bombers, flashes of light appeared only very briefly when, at the moment of death, they merged with their enemies, who were nothing but projections of themselves. The coming together of their exploding selves with their deluded ideas about the ones they had hated produced fleeting sparks of light. Then everything immediately went black. It was a much darker black than the parts of hell frequented by mere ordinary haters who hated themselves and others without resorting to weapons, only with their venomous thoughts. What was behind this madness of self-destruction and murder? Extreme, fanatical belief in a god may begin as devotion, but it can turn into destructive violence that is undoubtedly not pleasing to the deity at all. It is nothing more than the fanatic's egocentric fantasy of fulfilling the most depraved vision that they can muster, supposedly to worship their deity. But in fact, they are confusing their own sense of self with their god. The fanatical believer thus becomes a devil, expounding the worst view imaginable. I periodically came upon these exploding men and women. Since they themselves exploded, while they exploded everyone around them, the result was a gory mess. Fingers, entrails, eyeballs, and hearts flew into space, and then came together to reform the bodies of the exploders into the bodies of those whom they had blown up. As the fragmented body parts of the two groups became mixed together and misassembled, there was massive confusion amongst the exploders and the exploded. I wondered what was going on, and one of the exploders, Omar, obliged by telling me his story. Omar had assumed that he would go straight to heaven after exploding people in the earthly realm. He was outraged that instead he had ended up in the depths of hell. And not only that, but his body and mind kept mixing with the bodies and minds of those whom he had blown up. He hated them so much that this made him even angrier and even more eager to blow them to smithereens. On Earth, in the human realm, Omar had firmly believed that his actions were righteous and that he would be welcomed into a paradise as a hero. He had unquestioningly trusted the fanatical exhortations of leaders who preached condemnation of apostates and of infidels who practiced other religions. He became convinced that his belief system was the only true salvation for humankind. People must convert to that view or be killed. Omar was easily recruited because he had recently been diagnosed with early signs of a cancer that affected the lining of his heart. It was fatal, but he had no idea how long he would live. Would it be just a few months or many years? Regardless, he was quickly convinced that the pleasures of heaven would be much better than languishing in the hospital or stuck in a bed at home under his family's care. His anger about his medical death sentence, the injustice of it, leaked into anger about the injustices he saw in the world around him, which were pointed out to him by his handlers. Influenced by this negative view of the world, he had developed an absolute extremist faith, which his handlers slyly disguised behind the banner of a religion of peace. He was determined to die as a beloved and admired martyr and not just a cancer statistic. Here, in hell, Omar regurgitated his fanatical thoughts of persecution, injustice, and revenge over and over. The thought patterns became reactivated each time he set off explosions, killing everyone near him. But nobody died. Everybody, including Omar, just felt the pain of their hell bodies being hurled all about, and then recombining and starting all over again. He hated them. They hated him. But they had all been mixed together so many times that really there was no distinction between himself and them. Omar had been born in the desert. His family was traveling in a camel caravan when his mother went into labor and died in childbirth. He was adopted by the wife of the caravan leader. It was she who chose his name on the seventh day, Omar, meaning life. Those who convinced him to be a suicide bomber were the elders within his community who presented their wretched way of life as the template for all human society. A few nice touches actually made it seem attractive. Everyone in the community shared equally in food, so nobody starved. Crime was minimal, and sexual improprieties were almost unheard of. Female disobedience was rare, thanks to the exceedingly harsh punishments unfailingly carried out in public. The camaraderie and sense of belongingness among the brotherhood of true believers were so gratifying to Omar that truly he would gladly lay down his life for his friends. Again and again and again. Sewer of the Evil Immortals, Mbaya Moja. We traversed the valley of burning corpses that never died. At one point, the valley narrowed into a deep, flaming ravine from which a great stench was erupting. The ravine then turned into a tunnel filled with boiling feces, severed heads, eyeballs, ears, arms, legs, all putrefied. The heads were alive, and although they were separated from their bodies, each head could sense all the various body parts, including the heightened pain of severed nerves, veins, and arteries, and the dull pain of constant decay. The sense of smell in the heads of the hell beings was heightened 10,000-fold, and the taste buds 100,000-fold. These miserable creatures experienced nothing but a constant flow of boiling feces through their mouths and nasal passages. The flow suffocated them in the way that water torture might, creating a constant sense of drowning. They were always on the verge of drowning and wanted to cry for help, but their mouths were always full of excrement, and regardless, there was no help to be had. On rare occasions, the gas that exuded from the filth exploded, burning the heads and body parts to a crisp. The fertilizing power of the boiling feces always brought the parts back to full life. I became overcome by the stench. At that moment, I heard a soft voice tell me, "You have to look." I looked. Now I could see how each of these heads was attached to a history of treating their fellow men and women like shit as if they had no feelings. The history of one head was written on its face, and I leaned forward to examine it. This man, Shomari, had been born in the lush jungle of Central Africa, in a village blessed with excellent resources, nutritious fruits and root vegetables, game animals in abundance, an infinite amount of clean, fresh drinking water. His parents raised him lovingly. His father, a merchant, taught him the ways of the world, taking Shomari as a pre-adolescent to visit villages and cities throughout their land and even to neighboring countries. While visiting the capital on one occasion, Shomari and his father encountered a dangerous situation. A group of rebels was rioting in the streets, armed with guns and Molotov cocktails. The father immediately told his son to run as fast as he could from the center of the city toward the river. As they both were running, one of the rebels caught the father and pushed him to the ground. After grabbing all of his money and goods, the rebel mercilessly shot Shomari's father in the head, killing him instantly. The boy was shocked and in tears, but kept running to save his own life. When he came to the outskirts of the capital, Shomari found himself surrounded by a larger group of rebels who taunted him because of his tears. Fearful of being captured and enslaved, he managed to escape and make his way back to his own village, where he described the cruel death of his father, but kept to himself the shameful taunting. Anger brewed within his mind, and he plotted his revenge. In a few years, the rebel group that had been in the capital that day became the legal government of the country. The very man who had killed Shomari's father was now general of the new regime. The youth joined that army and over time became a non-commissioned officer. Shomari gathered together a band of disaffected fellow non-commissioned officers and ordinary soldiers who all nourished a hatred toward the regime, and the group eventually planned a coup, while outwardly pretending to be loyal to their officers and the government. On the 10th anniversary of the revolution, this group, which had grown to several score, stormed the presidential palace and slew the ruler and his ministers and general, including the murderer of Shomari's father. Shomari had avenged his father's death and his own humiliation, but that was not enough. The smell of his victim's blood gave rise to a new desire for full power. With the support of his compatriots, Shomari declared himself the new ruler of the country and gave himself the intimidating name Mabaya Moja, the Evil One. He promised that he would cleanse his land of all the brethren of those who had ruled so mercilessly for the last 10 years. His new army entered the districts where the leaders of the previous regime had lived and systematically murdered all males over the age of 10. Boys aged 6 to 10 were brought along and trained to be part of Mabaya Moja's enlarged army. They were instructed in weaponry and savagery. Over time, Mabaya Moja's heart hardened more and more. He had no love for his wives and no love for his children. They were just ornaments of his power lust. At the celebration of the 25th anniversary of his regime, a group of rebels stormed his palace and butchered him, his family, his ministers, and his government. That was the day that he arrived in this dark tunnel of hell, like a turd in a sewer. Mabaya Moja treated people like they were worthless hunks of meat. In his ruthlessness, he granted no mercy to others. As a result, the karma of his murderous ways made him experience his life in hell as a discarded piece of shit, despicable and without value. Mass murderer Yao Mogwa. Hell beings were interconnected with one another in various ways, so that as a result, they were often grouped together in gangs. These groupings had their origin in the interplay that the members had together during their lifetimes in other realms. In one area where various gang leaders resided, they carried on with their aggressive tactics of intimidation and violent murder. It was clear to them that they were already dead, and indeed in hell. But so strong was their habit of evil doing that repentance never occurred to them. They continued their activities as if they had not died and still wielded power over their victims. One such gang leader was Yao Mogwa. As a teen, he had encountered his mentor, Master Chao, a swordmaster of great renown. This master was known for his ruthless take-no-prisoners style. In battle, Master Chao slaughtered many warriors and cut out their gallbladders. From these collected organs, he withdrew the bile that was present at the time of death. Periodically, he prepared a powerful poison from a mixture of the bile, certain tree barks, and products of the corrosion of various metals. At the beginning of each battle, he would run his sword through the poison, making his blade doubly murderous. Yao became the student of Master Chao and requested to learn the secret of the poisonous formulas that he had perfected. Master Chao agreed on the condition that Yao must add his own bile as well to his mixture. In addition, he must vow to never have pity for any of his victims nor regret for any murders that he committed. Yao agreed to Master Chao's conditions, and on a new moon midnight, a ritual was performed. Chao sharpened the point of his blade on flint, sending out a shower of sparks, and heated the blade in a flame emanating from burning flesh, while chanting an incantation that would keep Yao alive through the ordeal to come. The blade point was plunged quickly into Yao's abdomen, and bile and blood spurted out and were gathered as Yao vowed never to have pity or regret. He never broke this evil vow. Yao subsequently became a soldier in the service of Duke Li, a feudal lord in the south of China. Over time, he became renowned as a skilled assassin who would take a life as casually as a cook chopping off the head of a fish in the kitchen. He was feared not only by his targets, but also by his supposed allies. Even Duke Li, his lord, who valued his abilities highly, was wary of Yao, who was fully capable of turning on him without warning. When Duke Li became too old to rule, he was ready to appoint his first son, Shang Di, as his successor. Shang Di had always complained to his father that Yao, though a highly skilled swordsman, was excessively cold-blooded and unsparing, killing not only the designated targets, but also their families and unsuspecting neighbors. Shang Di distrusted Yao, and Yao, in turn, despised him. Yao was fully aware that he might be banished or even executed in the new succession. One night, he sneaked into the palace and slaughtered his master, also hacking Shang Di to death along with all the other sons and daughters in an unprecedented bloodbath. The next morning, Yao Mogwa declared himself the new lord. There would be absolutely no resistance to the wrath of Yao. He took command of the army and trained them by his own methods. It was his ambition not just to be lord, but to become a king over conquered territories. His army grew into one of the most vicious killing machines of its time. Yao was a coarse and unsophisticated person who resented the refined and educated aristocratic classes. Even more, he despised those who, through their spiritual efforts, claimed to have discovered that the material realm was not the supreme realm. Because Yao's ferocity concealed shameful feelings of inferiority, he was compelled to destroy anybody or anything that reminded him of transcendent thought, transcendent knowledge, and a transcendent society based on the joining of heaven and earth. His view was simple. The material world of earth was all that existed, and any notion of heaven was an absolute lie. Because of this, in the process of conquering vast expanses of land, Yao not only killed soldiers, but also made a point of slaying all saintly elders and sages. He commanded that all books of wisdom be burned. All sacred art was desecrated and destroyed, replaced by images of himself. In middle age, Yao arranged the building of his own future mausoleum within a massive complex of underground caverns. The loss of thousands of lives when stones and earth collapsed on the laborers excavating the cave complex was of no importance. A great statue of Yao was constructed, along with statues of his assassin generals and their troops. He had scholars write testaments and histories of his accomplishments that were then carved into stone and metal, and inked into books of special tree bark that would last for generations to come. At Yao's death, his mummified corpse was placed inside a recess of the gigantic statue of his form. But his mind made its way into the underworld of the Hells. Although he entered Hell as an individual Hell being, the force of his evil was so strong that he also engulfed other Hell beings, those who had been both his enemies and his allies, into his hellish block of power. Soon after arriving in Hell, a horrendous realization seized Yao with panic. He was in the midst of habitually barking orders at all beings he encountered, when suddenly he became aware that every part of his Hell body, from his skin and eyes and teeth to his internal organs, was an individual whom he had exiled, abused by enslavement, or violently murdered. All of the beings who violently despised him were what he was now composed of. From the moment he realized this, Yao remained in a state of uncontrollable terror. Every breath, every feeling, every thought, every component of his physical being, all were made up of everyone who hated him and everyone he hated. There was not a hair of separation between him and them. The beings that made up his body had nowhere to escape, nor could he escape from them. They would be inextricably bonded together in one gigantic body of hatred for aeons without number. Doppelganger Pak Minsu. We wandered through a valley strewn with what seemed like bricks, industrial debris, and dismembered humans in the shapes of snakes and bats. The valley had an earth-like paved road that was made up of bodies packed tightly together, creating a throbbing asphalt. There was a constant parade of weird vehicles constructed from misshapen male and female Hell bodies. The axles tortured them as they turned, and the tires were also made up of Hell beings, who barreled over the frightful road of living corpses. The air was heavy with the noxious stink of poisonous gases and acidic liquids that were burning holes into the asphalt beings and vehicle beings. This zombie highway led into what looked like a large city engulfed in clouds of poison. The Buddha of Hell reached out and enveloped my consciousness with water from his hand that cooled and refreshed. This soothing envelope allowed me to enter the infernal city without being overcome by the pernicious atmosphere. A constant rain of burning acid poured down, forming puddles and streams that engulfed the inhabitants. Periodically, the poisoned water spread out in shockwaves over the beings, inflaming them with chemical burns that caused unbearable searing pain. Gigantic red hell ants with powerful mandibles swarming in rapid, erratic patterns scrambled crazily over the zombie inhabitants. Their relentlessly snapping jaws chomped into the wounds of the acid-burned hell beings and hungrily sucked out the poison. The acid was instantly transformed by each ant's body into a gaseous substance that was shot out of a terminal orifice in the form of superactivated flames, increasing the heat and noxious vapors into an even more monstrous inferno. In the distance, I spied a figure running away from one of the gaseous explosions. Before my eyes, he was blasted into fragments, and his bloody habit body was spattered across the pavement and against the buildings. Each of the bits of his body was in complete agony, for they were not dead. Each part of his body had a complete holographic consciousness, so that the individual parts suffered from the intense burning, and the whole collection of parts was also suffering the cumulative anguish of each part. Then I observed the parts reconnecting, creating a freaked-out doppelganger of this wretched hell being. At the moment all the parts came back together, I was brought forward to meet him. The man communicated that his earthly name was Pak Minsu. Apparently his demise had been quite recent, because he did not yet understand that he was dead, and he was confused by this hellish city with all its grotesque phenomena. He also did not realize that this very environment was perpetually attacking him. Each time his hell body was blown apart, he only experienced the pain of it. But he kept forgetting that it had happened before, countless times. It was like a weird twist on deja vu. Instead of an event that seemed to have happened before, but it didn't, the same event was constantly happening, yet he neither remembered it nor learned from it. The power of his habitual patterns had followed him to death in magnified form, creating a delusory hall of mirrors in which his mental suffering manifested again and again in a cruel repetitious compulsion of multidimensional proportions. Minsu was not even aware that he was unaware, but he did intuit that something was terribly, terribly wrong. Minsu's human life had been one of privilege and luxury, born the only son of a family that for generations had been money changers, bankers, and accountants. He had a natural genius for math that developed into a fixation with numbers, especially those with currency symbols appended to them. After graduating from business school and a top institute of technology, he was welcomed into the family banking company and placed in charge of its hedge funds. Young Minsu designed complex programs that could forecast the effects of political events on various markets. Not surprisingly, the financial whiz kid raked in vast sums of wealth for both the company and himself. Minsu was not just a finance wizard. He was also a dreamer with creative instincts and the determination to achieve some unique act of invention that would earn him fortune and acclaim. With greed and ambition, mixed with brilliance and imagination, he succeeded in combining artificial intelligence and robotics to design an automaton that would become the ideal worker. When Pak Min-soo presented his proposal to his family and the company executives, they were amazed at his intellectual prowess and thrilled at the prospect of a workforce that didn't have to be paid or given benefits. It took several years of tireless, compulsive work for Min-soo to perfect a humanoid robot with an artificial brain. The first prototype was an instant success. This robot was so smart, its intelligence was equal to that of Min-soo himself. He named it Chip. A tear came to Min-soo's eye when he pondered that in Chip he had found a soul brother or a second self. Together, the two of them concocted a plan enabling them to produce, for a reasonable price, robots of various kinds that could do all manners of physical labor as well as intellectual tasks. Dangerous work, menial work, medical work, research work. The possibilities were dizzyingly endless. Min-soo and Chip both labored with the same machine-like efficiency. The initial factory produced thousands of robots in the first year. Min-soo and his alpha robot collaborator were exhilarated. They imagined a complete city dedicated to robot production and also a think tank in which humans and robots would collaborate. Over a period of 25 years, the city was built. It became a great metropolis of the world, attracting leagues of financiers, techies, eggheads, and engineers to operate the financial institutions, colleges, think tanks, and factories. But, as always in life, a downside was inevitable. What had begun as a beautiful city became a drastically polluted one, because the processes involved in making the robots produced highly toxic effluents and gases, polluting both water and air. Although humans and robots alike were deeply concerned, for some strange reason, no one seemed to come up with a solution, although the industry leaders kept assuring the public they were working on it. As diverse businesses in the city expanded and employed more robots and people, the city became choked by thick fogs containing deadly contaminants. Meanwhile, Pak Min-soo had become one of the richest people on the planet, married to one of the world's most beautiful women and possessing the most precocious children. Like a king in his counting house, he was most happy when digitally tracking his coffers, and he found endless ways to invest and amass even more hoards of money. He lived in utmost luxury, still in the city that he had built and polluted. With his mega fortune, he could have lived anywhere in the world. But truth be told, the pollution from his city had already been transported by winds and rains to other parts of the world. One day, as Min-soo was stepping out of his towering office building, gases that had been collecting in the air were ignited by static electricity, sending a wind of fire sweeping through the city. A gigantic boom rattled his eardrums, and he started running like crazy. Hundreds of people around him were dropping like barbecued flies. Robots, too, were being destroyed. As he struggled to climb over the human and mechanical bodies, frantic to escape from the flaming winds and suffocating clouds, he began to falter. Time slowed down as he felt himself sinking into the pile of bodies. The majority of the population perished, and thousands of robots were damaged beyond repair. The once soaring intellect of Min-soo had no comprehension that his own brainchild, the brilliant city of robots, had destroyed him along with many, many others. His consciousness hopelessly muddled, Min-soo continued to run from the wrath of death. running and being blown apart, running and being blown apart. Unable to break through to him in his self-creative delusion, I slowly moved away, at a loss for how to understand the fantastic vision I had just witnessed. The Raging Giant, Momotrollo. A totally different scenario awaited us as we arrived at a bridge of flaming magma that carried us into the region of the Hell Giants. This realm was spread across an infinite expanse of gases that burned a hot blue-gray and exuded constant sulfuric vapors that gathered into clouds. The Hell Giants were each the size of a mountain. Their collective presence manifested as multitudinous ranges spreading out in all directions. Each giant was in a panic, and cries of anguish constantly ripped from their mouths. Upon looking closely, I saw that each giant's body had its skin burned away, exposing the hideous fact that its veins, arteries, and sinews were composed of endless numbers of other bodies. All of these frantic beings were desperately trying to escape from the giant of which they were a part. Each of the giant's organs contained even more beings, also attempting to escape. But escape from what? Escape from where? Not only did the circulatory, lymphatic, and digestive organs contain many beings, but the organs themselves were made up of beings who had taken on the forms of those organs. The blood cells were beings. The food, the thick, semi-digested mass of chyme, and the excrement were beings. The body fluids were beings. All were inextricably connected. The giant experienced the combined pain of all the smaller beings, and the smaller beings experienced all the pain of the giant. Thus, the cycle of anguish was in constant violent motion. Panic by panic, this anguish increased incrementally. I paused to look at one of the grotesque giants. She looked quite gruff, but her cries sounded like the groans of a haggard old grandmother. The giant looked down at me with terror in her eyes. She conveyed to me that in life she had been a human woman called Momotrollo, the child of a nomadic family in the high mountains of the Land of Snows. She had been married off at a young age to two brothers, who provided for her through their skills in animal husbandry. While she helped with herding the yaks and dree, fleecing their wool, her primary labor was in the summer season, milking the dree, churning the cream, and making yogurt, butter, and fermented liquor. She was extremely efficient at her duties, and both brothers were satisfied with her. Between them, she bore several children. But as Momotrollo aged, she became more and more dissatisfied with her station in life. Her discontent reached its height when she saw a family of a rich merchant passing through in a caravan. She glared with envy at the merchant's wives, with their smooth skin and shining hair, and the gold and turquoise hanging heavily from their ears and necks. Though Momotrollo was barely 40 years old, she felt ancient in comparison to them, with her deep wrinkles and sun-darkened face, her plain clothing. The merchant's children were impeccably garbed and had a healthy, clean glow to their faces, while her own offspring were bedraggled and snot-faced. The sight of this privileged and pampered family made her feel lowly and deprived. The thought of the caravan gnawed at Momotrollo's mind long after it had vanished and was hundreds of miles away from her mountain valley. She seeded hatred toward her own life. Why couldn't she have been born into a wealthy merchant's family? She despised her unkempt husbands, who trudged through the hills herding the big shaggy animals. At night, one or the other man would grab her roughly for warmth and release. Their smell sickened her. Momodrolo could barely contain her simmering rage. Ever demanding, ever uncooperative, she even began to abhor the innocent animals who nourished her. Life held no meaning. She lived from her bile, always ready to blurt hateful words. She perceived everyone as her enemy, including her children, who could do nothing right. Without warning one day, she lost her elder husband and two of her sons when they were killed in a sudden avalanche while bringing a small herd of yaks to market. She did not shed one tear, but her bitterness increased. She blamed her dead husband for this disaster. For the rest of her life, Momodrolo complained about this ill fortune, recounting it to every person she met, repeating and repeating. But most of her time was spent sitting by the fire, stewing in the acid of her bilious emotions, as one by one, every member of her family died from illness or accident. Their deaths did not move her at all. They simply added to her resentment over her own misfortunes. After each death, the local priest attempted to comfort her and uplift her heart. Cursing to drive them away, she shouted after them that their teachings were pure nonsense. A constant source of food and wool was still provided to Momodrolo, who had hired some men to take care of her herds. She was able to trade for barley and sugar. Unable to open herself to others, she could only open her mouth and shovel in food. She ate constantly, endlessly, and over time became overweight, diabetic, and bilious. One day she noticed blood in her stool and in her spittle. She began to feel quite ill. She had stinging in her mouth and anus because of the bile mixed with blood. After several weeks of illness, she could no longer defecate. There was a mass inside her belly like solid concrete that would not move. At dawn one morning, she felt the call of nature and went to the field. Her bilious colon prolapsed and she bled to death. Contrary to her wishful fantasies, Momodrolo was not reborn to the family of a wealthy merchant. When her consciousness reawakened following her humiliating death, she was a grotesque giant in hell. Transition, Jhana Sophia. The Buddha of Hell guided me through the flaming molten mountains that towered above an infinite inferno of beings, a fire who could not die. From the sides of the mountains, lava strings flowed like rivers, adding more and more heated pressure to the burning hell beings, wreaking havoc and overwhelming them. The acrid smoke pervading the environment made it very difficult to see. All that could be heard were screams of extreme panic. The sights and smells and sounds were so upsetting that I found it difficult to follow the flaming mountain path. The Buddha then gestured, and through the texture of the flame, a magnificent vision of his compassion manifested in the form of a young, feminine, deity-like presence, radiating both serenity and compassion. As the goddess neared, she and the flames around her appeared inseparable. Unlike the Buddha, she emanated a red hue, although it sometimes briefly shifted to other colors depending on the reflections from the activities of the hell beings. She first appeared above the hustle and bustle of confused hell beings who were being shifted here and there through the varied machinery of sufferings. With everyone angry and terrified, pushing, yelling, and crying. Her face and her eyes, brimming with tears, reflected sadness and concern for each of the individual beings trapped in this endless burning field. Although She was just above them, offering solace. The confused beings were much too involved in their personal agonies, fears, and violence toward the other hell beings as they all rushed about. She looked upon them all like a young mother, caring about the travails of each child who fell beneath her glance. Her presence was there to ease and comfort. As my thoughts went to her, her thoughts came to me. She showed me that, no matter how lost I might feel as a visitor to this hell realm, the hell beings trapped in the flames of their own hatreds and passions could be comforted by compassion and caring directed toward them. For them, the goddess was a beacon of fiery splendor, yet it was hard for me to see her form in clear focus, because her essential nature was no different from that of the hell flames surrounding her. Could the hell beings, whose energy was utterly consumed by their own pain, even catch a glimpse of her? I was saddened to think that although her mercy was always accessible, it was also so subtle that it escaped the perception of most. When I wondered what her name was, she instantly told me, Jana Sophia. It was clear that both she and the Buddha of Hell were of the same essence. Jana Sophia became another guiding light on my journey through the various hells, always quietly caring and always offering help whenever it was requested. Her tears and my tears mixed in the knowledge that there was so much suffering and that there were so few sufferers asking or willing to be helped. They were simply overwhelmed by their experiences as they moved through the various stages of their hell journey. The transitional spaces, the in-betweens, or bardo regions, and the peripheral edges of hell are distinctive because the contrast of textures is reminiscent of the human realm. Here, in these spaces, the Buddha of Hell offers illumination that can awaken beings and allow them to be reborn from hell into a higher realm. The co-emergent textures of water and fire, phenomena of opposite character that emerge from the Buddha's palm, point to awakening from the habitual traps of one's previous birth and the lifetime in hell. The Trap, Jacques Neal. There was a hell denizen trapped at the border between the hot and cold hells. When he saw me, he was eager to communicate his story and why he was so distressed at finding himself in this terrible place. His name was Jacques Neal, and he had lived an unexceptional but pleasant enough life. He enjoyed gourmet meals and proudly drove the German or Italian cars that he purchased every few years. His attention was drawn to global politics and the intellectual debates of the day. With his chic wife, he had a loving but stormy relationship. While their bored children fiddled with electronic devices, the couple spent many hours in animated discussion of their convictions and aesthetic passions according to various psychoanalytic and philosophical fashions and postmodern trends of thought. Jacques had no interest in spiritual pursuits. Yet, as he grew older and began to contemplate existential questions raised by the inevitability of death, he realized that despite his fairly happy activities, he was at a loss to identify a personal raison d'être. When he imagined himself departing from the world with nothing but a sense of meaninglessness, he felt angry. What was the point of it all? While Jacques generally kept up a cheerful demeanor, inside he was perturbed by the constant gnawing of ennui. It was depressing to think that his own life would simply end, yet he could not conceive of any alternative. Other than his own children and grandchildren, he didn't care about anything continuing. He would eventually die, and the body would turn to ashes. Everything would end then. As a modern man educated in science, Jacques was convinced that human life was simply a collection of chemical and electrical responses. The mind was nothing other than the physical activity of the brain. Like everyone else, he accepted this as the undisputed truth. Life is an accident. Humans and other living things just appear out of nothing, and they disappear in the same way. Boop, birth. Boop, death. Pop, nothing. That was it. This sense of nothingness led to an ever-present anxiety within. But Jacques did not show it, nor try to talk about it, nor try to change it. When his time came, Jacques' corpse was electrically cremated almost immediately after he passed away in the hospital. There was supposed to be nothingness now, so it came as a nasty shock to find that there was still an identity of myself. Jacques could no longer find his own material body to hold on to, but ironically, he still had a very strong attachment to the idea that everything was made of material substance. This trap of hell in which he found himself was perceived by Jacques as a cruel trick of nature that had been played on him. He balked at this cruelty and grew more and more furious. Every other being in hell rubbed him the wrong way, and he detested them. He and they were stuck together in what felt to him like one continuous, interminable reaction of irritability. It was a chemical combustion that kept igniting and reigniting. There was no end to it. Jacques had been entrenched in the hot hells for what in earthly times would be hundreds of thousands or even millions of years. His forced intermingling with other beings was tinder for his constant irritation. It was as if each touch, each contact with any being, caused a chemical reaction within him that made him hate these others even more. And he was constantly burned by the irritation in the way that an acid can ignite and burn when mixed with other compounds. Jacques believed that this extremely hot chemical reaction was going to last for eternity. As he became angrier and more upset, the experience of hell became hotter and hotter and more claustrophobic. Panic had him in its grip. His only hope was that the claustrophobia and the panic would cause him to faint and lose consciousness. No such luck. In hell, there is no time off. The solidification of Jacques' negative habits of mind caused him to get trapped in the transitional state, moving from one perceived solid reality to another. Jacques' unshakable conviction that human life is limited to gross matter turned completely around on him when he entered hell. First trapped in his concepts of the human realm, he was then trapped in the concepts of the hell realm. Deprived of the escape into nothingness he anticipated upon death, he was imprisoned in an alternate world of endless, fiery suffering. I tried to speak with Jacques, but I had forgotten that, being without material form, I had no voice. The Buddha of Hell then appeared beside me as the sound of a stringed instrument playing a range of tones. Somehow, my mind entered into the sound, and this gave me some ability to communicate with Jacques and try to draw his attention to the Buddha's presence. Jacques heard the notes, but instead of receiving them as communication, he reacted to them as just another source of irritation, and so my effort was rejected. He became angry with me and angry at himself, because none of this made any sense. was all outside of any kind of logic, reasoning, or science that he could grasp. I appealed to the Buddha to communicate with Shock, since my attempt had failed. The Buddha manifested the sound of the instrument's scale length, an exquisite primordial song. This pure celestial tones, so subtle compared with the ordinary sensations of materialistic life, was sadly beyond Jacques' ability to apprehend. If he could just listen instead of squirming with irritation, he might find the secret of making his way out of hell. I could only pray that the repetition of notes would one day penetrate his heart and uplift Jacques and others like himself. Even for those who believe only in the material, the immaterial might in the end set them free.